South Dakota artists are gathering in the hills for the biannual State Arts Conference. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. This year's conference will explore the impact of the arts in health and healing. Christopher Bailey delivers a keynote speech. Bailey is former co-director of the Jameel Arts and Health Lab and founder of the WHO Arts and Health Program in Geneva, Switzerland. I caught up with him via Zoom to talk about his journey to the Black Hills.
What a wonderful name for a show, In the Moment. Yes. As a professionally trained actor, that phrase has a lot of resonance to me.
Thank you for that. We thought hard about naming that show, and I'm glad that it does resonate with you. I want to start with your journey to South Dakota. You have Midwestern roots in Minnesota and in Missouri and in Iowa. Coming to the Dakotas and talking with artists from across the region, really, from our tribal communities, from the Black Hills, from across the state, what are some of the messages that you want to bring about the connection between arts and healing? I'll just let you begin where you'd like to here, and then I'll follow up with some questions that I've been ruminating on.
Well, that phrase that you just use, beginning where I'd like to begin, that's actually cutting to the core of creative arts therapies. The phrase that we use is meet people where they are. And there's a tendency when we talk about arts and health to over-medicalize it, to think, if you're feeling a certain way, I prescribe this poem, read it tonight and call me in the morning. And that's not really how it works. Fundamentally, it's about meeting people where they are and taking a journey together. And so that's, I'm going to be doing a lot of listening when I'm in the Dakotas and observing and interacting. I don't know what my message is going to be until I hear what people are feeling and thinking and saying and doing. And then at that point, it's going to be a dialogue. But I guess if I had to boil it down to a single message, it's actually just that. Listen to each other, talk with each other, enjoy your differences, enjoy your similarities, and live in the moment.
Yeah, I believe listening can be a form of creative expression, can be art. And that's what I study and practice. Tell me what you think about listening and how just the act of listening to one another can also be creatively collective.
Well, it can be life-saving. A number of years ago, when I was at WHO, during my 22 and a half year career there, I was participating in the suicide awareness campaign of that year. And the slogan we had was, just listen. And the idea is when you are interacting with somebody close to you that you think may be considering some form of self-harm, there's a tendency to tell them how to feel. Cheer up, snap out of it. Life's not that bad. Come on. And that actually can have one of two effects on the person. On the one hand, the person might say, oh, you're right, I shouldn't feel this way. And then their feelings become submerged and they feel shame and stigmatized for feeling that way. Or it could have the reverse effect where they become enraged. And similarly, in, let's say, music therapy, if someone's feeling sad, you don't play happy music. That can actually set them off. Mm. It's saying, you're not listening to me. What you do if someone is feeling sad is you play sad music. And then what happens is instead of becoming sadder, they become alert and they feel like, oh my God, you're acknowledging my state. You're actually listening to me. And at that point, you can take a journey together.
Yeah, we're afraid to do that, aren't we? We resist that out of fear. What are we afraid of?
Well, we're afraid of doing the wrong thing, which is understandable. But we're also, our attention span has gotten so small in our society today. We want easy answers. We want to be able to press a button or hit a link and get our answer. And that's not how the journey to becoming a complete person works. It is a long-term commitment. It takes all of your being, and it's something you have to be patient with yourself on and with others. And that doesn't happen in an instant. You have to commit to it. And part of that commitment is also making a commitment to truly listen to each other.
We want a cure. And to your point about over medicalizing the arts in our health or in our lives, the arts don't cure, they heal. What's the difference? Help us make that distinction between what we're looking for when we integrate some kind of art, whether it's music, poetry, painting, into a healthcare setting or some kind of medical setting. What are we after?
Well, I'll go even further than that in terms of wordplay. I'll say the arts don't cure anything. They help us curate our lives. At a fundamental level, the arts help us in our personal and collective journey to find authentic meaning in our lives and the world around us and a sense of belonging. And that has a tremendous effect on our health and well-being. It is not enough simply to get medical technology to lengthen our lives. That life has to have been worth living. We had to have lived in the first place. And part of that definition is discovering for us, each of us, what that meaning is. And particularly working with tribal communities, that meaning is not necessarily individual, it's collective. And when I talk to the Lakota tribes or the Navajo elsewhere, in the West, they always make this point. They get frustrated when Western mental health experts come and they start probing into their personal past for individual cures. And they always have to say, wait a minute, we're not just individuals, we're a collective. And anything that doesn't involve the group isn't actually getting at who we are. And I find that totally compelling.
So you said curate our lives. Are there, not to make it a 10-step plan, but where do we begin with even thinking about that? Because as you said, the pressures on our attention, the pressures on our time, the pressures on our financial resources are acute. It can be easy to get distracted and then sit back and say, wow, where did the day, week, years go?
Yeah, whoops, what happened to my life? Uh-oh, it's gone.
Was that it? Is that all I get?
Oh well. Better roll into the grave. I could have done something, but I forgot. No, I think that's part of the commitment is to say to yourself and within your friend group to say, I'm actually going to schedule time where I am going to develop creative practice. And that could be something that you do or just simply participate in as an audience member. There was a really interesting study that was done by my colleague Daisy Fancourt at the University College London. She just recently published a book on arts and health, which called The Arts Cure, actually. In this study that she led, she took a cohort of tens of thousands of people in the UK over a 30-year period and was able to demonstrate quite definitively that simply going to an arts activity two or three times a week reduces your likelihood of depression by 50%. That's huge when you think about the economic impact of that, the strain on the health system, the social and emotional impact of that. Now, of course, I read that statistic and I think, well, what about that other 50%? And that's where the arts, I think the power of the arts really become important because it's not just about reducing illness, it's also about how to cope with that illness. For many people with clinical depression, for instance, you can medicate it, you can treat it, but it doesn't necessarily go away. It becomes a chronic condition that you have to live with. And the arts are a wonderful way of being able to cope with the everyday stresses of life, being able to maximize your talents and abilities to their highest degree, to be able to be productive, to contribute to community, to be able to acknowledge moments of joy. And if you can do all of these things, you have mental health, regardless of what diagnosable condition you may or may not have. And if you are suffering from chronic depression and you hear that, oh my God, it's like this big burden is off of your shoulders because you realize, yes, I would like to be cured, but I can actually thrive even living with this condition. I myself am very nearly blind. I have terminal glaucoma, and part of my journey has been not just how to cope with lack of sight, but how to find meaning in that journey that actually ends up being positive. The way a friend of mine put it one time, he said, "Chris, you may have lost your sight, but you found your voice."
I love that. If I live with without sight or with some other obstacle or barrier, if I live in rural South Dakota and I don't have access, I can hear someone saying, I don't have opportunities for three arts experiences a week in my hometown. Expand the view of that. What are we talking about? What should I be seeking out?
Well, I think there are two paths you can go with that question. The first path is that, according to the UN Declaration on Human Rights, which was signed in what, 1949 or something, everyone has a right to access to the cultural facilities and benefits of your society. And so I would, for one thing, advocate finding ways of giving people in rural communities access. That I don't think it's a case of just simply saying, oh, well, you're in a remote area, you're not going to get access. I think there are ways of getting access. And I've seen that firsthand, for instance, in the western counties of Ireland and the programs there, or in very rural areas of Africa and Asia, and my travels around the world. There are creative ways of doing it, particularly now with the internet. And I think, the pandemic proved that. On the other hand, the other way of approaching that question is to say, wherever you are in the world, whether it's urban or rural, it is the center of your world. And there is plenty to interact with. If I'm a visually impaired person in rural South Dakota, I would walk out into the Black Hills and I would listen to the way the wind caresses the mountains and visualize that landscape through the soundscape of my mind. And what does that mean to me? How can I express that? And that is the beginning of an artistic journey for me as a visually impaired individual in South Dakota to hypothesize.
One of the things I find here in South Dakota, and I think it probably resonates with you, I'm curious to know how many people don't consider themselves artists, but it's just a part of their heritage and their, somebody quilts, somebody cooks, somebody makes lefse, my great grandfather painted houses, but then he also made these delicate little still life paintings that I still have in my house. Never would have said artist on the census, he says house painter. But
Yeah, well,
human beings make art.
yeah, exactly. And that's been the case for countless millennia. I think it's a shame that in our modern society for the last few centuries, things are not validated unless we make a profit from it. And I think part of the whole arts and health movement is the purpose of art is not to become rich and famous. The purpose of art is to become a complete person. And if you can make a living at it, great, fantastic. And I think too often artists are shortchanged because it is such an enjoyable passion. People think, oh, well, you should volunteer it because it's so much fun. Particularly in the development sector, that's something I fight against. Artists should be paid. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean that, everything about creativity should be monetized. You're absolutely right. Having a aunt that makes a particular bolognese sauce by adding her touch of cinnamon is an artist. They have created something novel based on a tradition, and you taste something that's at once comforting and new at the same time. That's creation. And for me, I always like to go back to the etymology of words. Art, if you go back to the Latin, simply means to create with a skill or technique. I mean, that's literally what it means. And so if you're a house painter or a doodler or whatever, you're an artist by definition. We're all artists on one level or another, whether we want to call ourselves that or not. In fact, going back to the Navajo, what's interesting about that nation is that they don't even have a word for art because it is such a part of their lives. There's no reason to specify it.
For working artists who are working in some kind of healthcare or healing setting, what do they need to understand about the science? Or maybe a better question would be, if artists work to understand the science of how art can connect, in therapeutic settings, how do they apply it? What can happen when somebody who is great at teaching a writing workshop also understands the therapeutic uses of that?
Well, it can be quite revelatory. For instance, in the WHO 2019 report on the evidence base for the health benefits of the arts, one of the dozens of studies that were cited in that report was what happens in a hospital setting when you do something as simple as adding music to physical therapy after an accident or an operation. You can reduce the hospital stay by 50%. It changes the process, the neurology of healing. And it's quite remarkable. And I think having an understanding of the best practice of the science can be extremely useful to maximize that effect that's there anyway. I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, I was visiting a displaced persons camp outside of Abuja in Nigeria, and they had a thriving arts practice there of in all media, music, painting, dance, you name it. And as I was being shown these wonderful practices that they were doing, I asked a question that I would ask in any clinical setting. I asked, what is the greatest health challenge that you face in this refugee camp? And in unison, all the leaders said, witchcraft. And I thought, witchcraft, okay. Can you give me an example so I can better understand what you mean by that? And one woman said, yes, there's someone suffering under a spell just over that hill. I said, well, can we meet him? So we went over, and sure enough, there was this man there, older man, who was his face was contorted, he was yelling, he was deeply distressed. And I could tell just from the behavior that he was suffering from dementia. And so I asked if anyone there knew who he was. And one woman said, well, I come from his village. And I said, do you think you would know a song that he might know from his childhood? And she said, I think so. And I said, can you sing it? So she sings this song, the crickets, they sing, the crickets sing all day. All day, all day. And right then, the man suddenly became alert. He became aware of who he was and who the other people were. And the crowd was astonished. And they turned to me and they said, "Are you a witch?" And I said, "No, I'm from the World Health Organization. He has something called Alzheimer's disease. And music has this power to unlock connections that the disease is buried. But it's only temporary because music is an all-brain effect. It can, for that period of time that you're listening to the music and a few minutes afterwards, find detours around the damaged areas of the brain, but it doesn't actually cure the brain. It doesn't fix the Alzheimer's." And they said, So what should we do?" And I said, "You need to take him back into the community. You need to feed him and take care of him and sing to him 3 times a day."
That is a very powerful, powerful story.
But that also shows you where understanding the neurology and the biochemistry of how the arts affect you can augment the benefits that are there anyway without that knowledge. But you can cut through a lot of the societal stigma for certain conditions, but also the stigma for enjoying yourself, that there's nothing wrong with your kids wanting to dance and play music and all of those things. It's part of becoming both an individual, but learning how to be part of a group. And those are benefits that you carry with you your entire life.
The stigma of enjoying yourself, that feels like a big statement to me. What's of just like immersing your, say more about that, say more about that, please.
Well, I think in certain cultures, and some communities in America are no exception, there's this sense that, oh, we have to be working all the time. Enjoyment is frivolous. It's a waste. It's somehow a sin. It's not true. That part of, again, becoming a whole person is being able to acknowledge those moments of joy and cultivate them and share them and participate in them together. That's part of being a human being. And it's part of the definition of health and well-being, frankly.
It can be hard to release yourself to that deep experience, whether you're in a movie, in dark movie theater, trying not to cry at something that is so. I remember seeing Hamnet when it first came out, and I was like, there's not enough Kleenex in this theater for me to get through it. And finally, it was just like it the sh the movie itself gave me permission to just wipe snot on my sleeve. So that strikes me as a movie that kind of gets at this idea of what the arts do in our lives to express grief, for example, and to enter into
Oh,
that sad space.
what a beautiful film.
Oh,
And
it
there were so many things that I liked about it, including the fact that Shakespeare was not the central character. It was his wife. And that I thought was what a brave and powerful choice that was, because it would have been easier to make Shakespeare be the hero, right? And he's obviously an important character in the story, but he's not the central one. And but in the climax, without giving anything away, I'll be careful about spoilers. You have this emotionally fulfilling moment in the play itself where it doesn't just explain how community is created through a artistic aesthetic experience, but you are part of it. You feel like you are in that audience in the Globe Theater, in that movie theater. And you are that community for those 10 minutes, and you take that away from you, leaving the theater. You are transformed. And at the end of the day, that's what theater is about. It's about transformation. I mean, particularly Shakespeare. Just last week, I did. I have a series of things that I do on Shakespeare and well-being, and I was originally commissioned by Shakespeare's Globe in London to develop the first iteration of this piece, and now theaters around the world have been asking me to do local versions of it. And last week I did it at Shakespeare North Playhouse, which is near Liverpool, and our theme was youth mental health. And I specifically reached out to the local community, found young people who were using Shakespeare to address their own issues, some of them quite severe. And we talked about it, we performed it together, and it was just beautiful. To actually have a group of young people who have serious mental health challenges, from autism to depression to whatever, to each one of them speaking the to be or not to be monologue from their own perspective and experience, and realizing there are countless ways to do it, and each one is valid. And that's a wonderful thing to say about humans.
Did the pandemic, do you think, ignite a mental health crisis in our young people? Did it reveal a mental health crisis in young people? What
I
does
think
your
it
experience show us?
exacerbated it. I think it exacerbated it. I think it pre-existed the pandemic, but it ripped the Band-Aid right off. And I don't think it's gotten better. When I go around the world and I talk to young people, what I hear directly from them is a frustration that we're living in a society where people have our generation, well, my generation, I should say, are not making decisions that will leave the world a better place for them. And we may be the first generation to do that. And that is incredibly hard for them. And it feels like a betrayal. And and again, using basic creative arts practice, the first step is let them say it. Not to get defensive, not to say, no, it's not that way. Oh, we all felt that way. Oh, whatever dismissive comments one might make. Just say, go ahead, tell us, let them say it, and then see where you can go from there.
I don't know how old you are, but my question is for this generation of, Gen X, for example, when you hear that from young people and you feel the call to do better, where do you begin?
Well, I think it goes back to the beginning of this conversation. You begin by listening. And the other thing that I think is so important about the arts, when you start talking about social well-being and social change, is that there isn't a single answer for every community and society. It'll vary, of course. But what is common is this thing we call the magic what if, which is not only the core of the arts, but it's the core of science. Once you've expressed your true feeling, then you ask the question, well, what if? And you follow that. And in science, that can be the formation of a hypothesis that can be tested, that could advance a solution. And in the arts, it could be the beginning of a fictional journey that can help us gain perspective on what's happening and maybe start to explore different pathways that we could try, and help us come to terms with the things that are outside of our control, and to give us possibility of the things that are actually within our control. One of my favorite touchstone quotes is from the Swiss psychologist Carl Jung, who said, loneliness is not the absence of people. Loneliness is the inability to express what matters to you most. And there are many reasons why we may not be able to express what matters to us most. We may think we just don't have the words. We may have a physical disability. We may be in the middle of an unequal power relationship at home or at work. And maybe there just aren't any words. Maybe the way to express it is through a sound, through a framed image, through a movement through space. But whatever it is, we need to try. And even if there's no answer, the act of expressing gives us control over our lives in moments when we may not necessarily feel in control.
When the ending comes back to the beginning, it's a really good story. So let's leave it there. Thank you, Christopher Bailey,
Okay.
so much for spending time with us.
My pleasure, and see you in South Dakota.
You can find more about the arts in South Dakota at artssouthdakota.org. And that's our conversation for today. I hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.